heard on great radio stations all across America. It's The National Defense with Randy Miller and Jerry Newberry.
This is The National Defense. Randy Miller along with Jerry Newberry, Communications Director for the BFW. And Jerry, our dedication as always.
Hey, we do this show for you, the men and women serving on active duty, the Guard and Reserves, millions of veterans out there, and of course, to all your families. Hey, we love you. We're here for you. God bless you.
So, Jerry, what newspapers or magazines do you read?
I read them all.
Good answer.
I read them all.
Good answer. Didn't think that'd be such a tough question.
How do you think I got so smart?
That must be it. Yeah.
That is it.
And, you know, once you get Highlights magazine colored in, you'll be done.
Reader's Digest.
Sure. That's right. Humor in uniform. That's about it.
Joke of the day.
Oh, speaking of the joke of the day, I mean, we got this political season is really turning into something to watch, isn't it?
And I'm going to tell you, Randy, I don't know if you recall, but months ago, you know, because I was involved in that for so many years in campaigns.
And, yeah, you're actually a speechwriter, right?
Yeah, speechwriter. Yeah. Came up with the radio ads, TV ads, and all sorts of stuff. And I wanted to get totally away from that. So this year,
so you got into BFW. You're right.
So if you recall, this year, for months I said, you know what? I'm not going to watch any of it.
Right.
I'm not going to listen to any of it. Whenever a political ad comes on TV, I'm going to turn it off. I'm just not going to put up with it this year. So what am I doing? I'm like this crack.
You're the lightning rod.
I'm unbelievable. Every night I go home. I turn on the cable. I look at the TV listings for the night.
Right.
You know, oh, geez, I'm going to watch NCIS or HBO.
Sure.
No.
Right.
No, I MSNBC, oh, Fox, yeah. CNN. You know, look at my thumb from flipping the tuner.
Well, you know, but like you were saying, Jerry, I mean, this is, it's too important.
It is.
It's just too important.
It really is.
And,
yeah.
You know, one of the things we're going to talk about on our program today is about this veteran voter registration, red tape, and a lot of the, you know, war veterans wondering whether they'll be able to vote for the candidate they want to.
Yeah, you know, we have thousands of veterans who aren't living at home, are living in some sort of government domicile.
Right.
Some of them are VA hospitals, and they want to vote. That's, you know, they fought to protect and defend the Constitution, gives us the right to vote, and it's very important to veterans to vote.
Absolutely.
And but you have to be able to register to do that. And it's a mess, and VA needs to be a little bit more cooperative in letting activists, concerned citizens, register voters.
And there's some kind of an act that they're talking about here.
Right.
Right, the Veteran Voting Support Act.
Right. And the VA, I mean, you know, they have to be careful, and I understand that.
Sure.
That you have to be careful who you let in to the facilities to make sure that, first of all, they're not stealing private information.
Right.
Second of all, that they're there for the right reasons, and that's to simply register a veteran, not to convince them to vote one way or another.
Right.
So,
you know, that's the kind of situation you always have, that
right,
that fear of any kind of voter registration deal. You know, it's always even MTV rocks the vote. I mean,
yeah,
you know, anything,
yeah,
like
right,
that, you've always got that kind of question about whether they're going to try to push one candidate over another or simply try to get people registered to vote so they can vote the way they want to.
Right. And you know what? And there's some other things when it comes to this voting issue that, you know, we have these far out groups out there who...
no. What?
Who think that anyone has the right to vote, which isn't true. You know, if you're convicted of a felony,
right,
you're denied the right to vote. And if you're convicted of a felony, well, they tell you that. You can't vote.
Sure.
So don't bring the United Nations into it and, you know, all these wacko groups trying to ensure that everyone can vote.
Well, and generally, if you're dead, you can't vote. But in Chicago, that's not true. I know you can vote two or three times if you're dead. So there's a lot of different situations there.
I thought Chicago had cleaned itself up there.
Well, just like Florida. They've all cleaned themselves up.
Well, yeah. That's you know, I've thought about that. That's going to be interesting. Yeah. You know, Florida, and all eyes are going to be on Florida naturally because of that.
I mean, it is a battleground state.
Right. You know? Absolutely. And there certainly can't be any more mistakes like there were last time. I mean, who's going to put up with it?
No, we'll be able to elect our own mistake. Anyway, on the program today, we got a lot of stuff going on. You went out to, are you just living at Leavenworth?
I am.
What is your deal out there with these guys?
It's hey, we've got a great relationship. And Leavenworth, if you're ever out Kansas, Missouri, try and take a trip to Fort Leavenworth.
And the people that aren't in the military or around the military may not understand what kind of a facility that is. But if you're in the military, you know exactly what Fort Leavenworth does.
Command Staff College and on and on and on. They have all these schools there that I'm not even going to list them there.
Right.
But that's where the military leadership goes.
Gets its training.
It's the intellectual center, not only of the military, but probably the country. Leavenworth has such a long history. I mean, it's been there forever. Right. Of course, most people associate the prison.
Right.
But really, it played a significant role in development of the country. Mm-hmm. There's actually spots where you can see where the wagon trains and so on and so forth made their trails, the Lewis and Clark Trail.
Sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it's interesting. We've been out there speaking to General Caldwell, General Cordon.
General Petraeus was there a couple of weeks ago.
Right. And most recently, I sat down and talked with Lieutenant Colonel Steve Leonard. Now, he's the guy who led the team that authored the New Army Doctrine. Interesting guy.
That's pretty major stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what's going to determine the direction of this army.
Right. And a lot of these things are being done now. They put this together from lessons learned. And it sounds like a real dry subject, but it really isn't.
Let me ask you this. How often is that done?
Well,
how often is there a new Army doctrine?
We hadn't had a new Army doctrine, going into the Gulf War. A lot of military, I can't say the words, strategists. They thought Vietnam was, they didn't learn enough military lessons from that. They learned a few, but they attributed the loss of Vietnam, I think, mainly to politicians. We were still fighting the Cold War when the Gulf War started. You know, it was the same military strategy.
Okay. So they kind of looked at the Vietnamese situation as more political than
they didn't learn enough
military.
Right. They learned some lessons from it,
right.
Didn't learn enough, and didn't put all the lessons they did learn into play. So, the Soviet Union disappeared.
Yeah.
But that strategy really didn't disappear until after the Gulf War.
I mean, that's amazing to me because I would think that you'd have to have a situation there where you'd have a new Army doctrine. And finally, there is one, so that's going to be good.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Can't wait to find out about that. It's coming up right here on the National Defense.
You're cleared for shore leave, sailor. Be back by the end of these messages.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The Veterans of Foreign Wars believes in active allegiance to flag and country. Through legislative activism and service to our military forces, veterans, their families, and communities, freedom starts at home. Pledge your allegiance again. If you're a veteran and served overseas, you may be eligible to become a member of the nation's elite veterans organization, the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
You've served your country. Now you can help your country serve others. Call 1-888-JOIN-VFW. That's 1-888-JOIN-VFW.
The following letters were written by our troops.
My dear fellow Americans, I truly appreciate your support. I was starting to wonder if people had forgotten about us over here, but then one of my buddies showed me this website, and now as tears are streaming down my face, I can see for sure that you haven't. Private Emily B., U.S. Army.
It's so heartwarming to see the American people not letting the men and women of the armed forces be forgotten. Your letters make a group of grown men, battle-hardened and gruff, act like a bunch of kids around a Christmas tree. Thanks. Staff Sergeant Matthew H., U.S. Army.
Your support may be the most important thing our troops can carry with them. But don't take our word for it. Take theirs. To show your support, visit americasupportsyou.mil. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Defense and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is Jerry Newberry. You're listening to the National Defense. And you know, for the past few weeks, we've been fortunate enough to travel out to Fort Leavenworth. Of course, you know, we've spoken to General Caldwell, General Cordon, some of the students out here. And we've discussed at length the new Army doctrine, and that is stabilization operations. And you know, I'm trying to get my hands around this thing. I think I understand it, but the goal is to help you understand it, because it's important that we know what the military is doing. You're not going to hear it from mainstream media, so we're going to bring it to you. Now, this new Army doctrine was written, and of course, when anything is written, somebody has to do it. And today we are going to talk to the man who sat down and wrote this thing, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Leonard. How are you, Colonel?
I'm fine. Thank you, Jerry.
Hey, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
And I don't get intimidated by muscle or brawn, but, you know, when it's obvious I'm sitting down with someone who's a hell of a lot smarter than me, then I'm a little bit intimidated. But seriously, the new Army doctrine, you, all kidding aside, you authored it pretty much with a lot of help. And I know that to put something like this together, it took a lot of coordination and interplay with higher-ups, enlisted people. Am I right on that? How did this thing get put together?
For this piece of doctrine, it actually took a different approach than you'd normally take with Army doctrine. Generally, what we'll do is when we write a manual like we did with our operations manual last February, that was a manual that was written with a lot of support from the very community that you mentioned, because that's where the expertise is. And when we write doctrine, it's not just an author or a writing team that sits down and writes what comes to mind. It's writers that draw from the experience and the wisdom of the practitioners. When we began the effort to write the Stability Operations Manual that we're releasing next week, the expertise isn't necessarily resident within the force. There's a lot of expertise that is. But generally, you'd look outside the force. You look in the development community. You look in the non-governmental community. You talk to our allies, and you draw off their experience, because when we talk about stability operations, you're talking about the types of activities that can range from humanitarian assistance through general nation building to security force assistance, a broad range of activities that we don't always perform. And the challenge there was bringing in the other agencies of the government, bringing in non-governmental organizations, bringing in the United Nations, different allied partners, and even members of the private sector because those are the practitioners and that's where the experience is.
And I was going to ask you about that. I mean, it has to be, if this was just something written by the military, it would be a challenge. But you mentioned these outside agencies, governmental, non-governmental. And I don't think most Americans understand how many different agencies come into play in Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, any idea on the numbers?
Not the numbers. It's more than we can count on two hands.
But you have, with any agency, especially government agencies, you have layers of bureaucracy.
Absolutely.
So how in the hell did you fight through all that? I mean, it seems almost like an impossible situation to bring all these agencies together. And
It's very personality-driven. We tried for a year to bring people together through different venues before we were finally successful last October. And we worked through the U.S. Institute for Peace, which is an organization that I didn't even know existed before last August. And they helped facilitate the door opening. But once the door was open, they turned around and said, now, it's up to you to keep the door open. It's up to you to engage. And over the course of a good year, that was travel back and forth to Washington, private meetings, lunches, dinners, coffee, walking down the street for ice cream with somebody from the State Department, whatever it took to keep the door open, keep the communication flowing, and the information exchange ongoing. And definitely a different process than you have within the military, which is very directive. We want to write doctrine within the military. We write a memorandum. We write a directive that says this is what we're going to do. And that process moves forward according to a specific timeline. When you start to introduce all these other agencies and organizations, they can walk away from the table anytime they want to. So it takes a completely different approach to bring them in and get them to stay at the table.
Usually, it's been my experience anyway, when you're dealing with agencies, quote unquote, they're all pretty parochial. They all have their own interest, and that's all they're concerned about. So what was the driving force for all these agencies to get involved in this? Was it a matter of saying, listen, we've had this situation in Iraq, in Afghanistan. It looks like we're going to face years, if not decades, of strife and unrest around the world, and next time we have to do it better? Is that kind of how
That's definitely part of the approach. We had to look at it from that, and that was part of the selling point, was this is something that we have to do together, Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have to walk this from violent conflict to peace, which is where the mantra of this document as the roadmap from conflict to peace came from. But it extended beyond that, as you mentioned, Jerry. We're not going to be in Afghanistan and Iraq forever. But understanding the threat to national security that is posed by failed and failing states, something that I think every leader in government recognizes, is the future national security has to contend with the fact that it's the disenfranchised populations of the world that are left behind when governments fail or states fail. That's where you see criminal networks evolve, where you see fundamentalists rise to power, where you see the training of violent extremists.
That's where the opportunities are.
Absolutely. Those are the voids, and those are the areas that we probably need to address the most. Not as a military, not as a joint force, not even as a government, but as an international community. That's where the security of the free world has to address first. That's where we need to be. And we approach them with that. We need to be able to do this together, and it's in all of our interests. Was it the Army's role to lead this? Probably not, but by default we did, because no one in government, within OSD, within the broader international community, nobody was as far along the road towards this as we were. We set a timeline, and we said, hey, not to sound too far-reaching here, but we can change the world together or we can try to do it separately. Let's put our agendas aside and let's see how far we can get in the next year and put something on the road. You don't ever overcome that institutional bureaucracy that you mentioned, the parochialism. That's still there. It was there up until the minute we went to the publisher. But we could come to agreements. We could reach consensus on certain points, little give and take here and there, and they would come on board, and we came to agreement.
The training manual, FM 3-7, that's the
7-0.
I'm sorry. General Caldwell said the field manual's revolutionary. What's he mean by that?
We look at doctrine as a driver for change. There's a traditional way of looking at doctrine. If you're like me and you grew up Catholic, we always saw doctrine as something very dogmatic, something that didn't change, or when it did change, it changed so slowly you almost wouldn't notice it. Doctrine's different. Army doctrine, in that sense, is a driver for change, and it's an impetus that pushes changes across organization, the equipment that we use, how we train, how we educate, the type of personnel we bring on board, what types of facilities we build. It's just huge implications towards change. The training manual, what it'll do is it'll put in place the mechanisms to train full spectrum operations, which is the central core theme of the manual that we published in February. 7-0 will institutionalize that within the training arena. It's revolutionary because it'll dispel the myth that the Army only focuses on major combat operations or peace operations. That's doctrine that allows our forces to train across a broad spectrum of activities from peace to war. So we have a very flexible, adaptive force with creative leaders. That training approach is revolutionary at its very core. And you'll see as that is institutionalized that across the force that you're going to see some pretty broad sweeping changes in terms of how we train and the end result product. It should be a much better, more adaptive force.
Hey, we'll have more from Lieutenant Colonel Steve Leonard in just a minute.
At ease, soldier. There'll be more Jerry Newberry in the National Defense after this.
In a military warehouse south of Washington, D.C., a USO stuffing party is in full swing. By the end of the day, volunteers will have stuffed over 10,000 USO care packages, packed them in boxes, loaded them on trucks, and sent them on their way to our soldiers in Iraq, Afghanistan, and military bases around the world. They'll stuff them full of things that most of us take for granted, but that our troops don't often have. Things like toiletries, playing cards, candy, books, little things. Little things that carry an enormous message to our troops. Little things like thank you, like we'll never forget you, like we're behind you 100%, like we love and cherish each and every one of you. Little things. We're all about the little things. We're the USO, so are you. For more information and to find out how you can help, visit us at uso.org. The USO, until everyone comes home.
Big Brothers Big Sisters presents 100 Years of Helping Kids.
Today, Kyle and his big brother Justin,
hello,
hi,
are here to share some stuff we've learned.
With kids, it's not always what you say, but how you say it.
Hey Kyle, you want to go to a foreign film festival?
Nah, that's boring.
Okay.
Hey Kyle, you want to go to a foreign film festival?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
From time to time, a kid may double dare you.
Wow, that looks heavy. Bet you can't lift it.
Are you serious?
I double dare you.
Okay.
See? I told you. Uh-oh.
Moments like these happen every day.
Making a big difference in the life of a child. To find out the many ways you can help support kids in your community, call 1-888-412-BIGS or go to BigBrothersBigSisters.org.
That's BigBrothersBigSisters.org.
This message brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Until next time.
I'm Jerry Newberry. You're listening to the National Defense. We're sitting down and talking with Lieutenant Colonel Steve Leonard. I'm gonna spit his title out here. It's a long one. Chief, Operational Level Doctrine, Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate. I'm only going to say that once. It's too long. revolutionizing the military, revolutionizing the way we confront situations. And we've talked about this before, that and I sound like a broken record at times, but the military has understood for a very long time, I think, that you don't win a war with body count. Because after shooting starts, you have a lot of things to deal with. That goes back World War II, actually World War I, Civil War, all the way around. But revolutionizing the way we...
What's the way we look at at problems, the way we approach situations? That's fundamental to what we're trying to do here, that we don't win wars, we win the peace. Enduring success, lasting success, however you characterize that, it doesn't come with just winning the fight. The fight only gets you part of the way there. It's the long-term aspects of winning the peace. Can you make that former enemy, can you make them a contributing member of the international community? The world at large, we don't need more problems. We need more solutions. And so we need a doctrine that supports getting there. We have really good warfighting doctrine. And I think there's very few people who would argue the fact that there's probably not another country in the world that can fight as well as we can fight. But that only gets us part of the way there.
Right.
It's if you don't help that former enemy or you don't help that adversary stand back up, rebuild and become a contributing member of the international community, then what you're left with is you are left with what a lot of people call an ungoverned space. That vast open area that lacks any kind of civil administration, that just becomes a breeding ground for future problems. And we need a doctrine that not only dealt with those situations but helped leaders think about those things. One of the things that we introduced last February was the whole concept of understanding. That when I grew up in the Army, like a lot of people at my rank and above, we had an enemy and we always knew what it was. We knew what their formations were. We knew what their doctrine was. We knew what they would wear. We didn't need to understand because we knew the Soviet Union. We knew how they operated. We knew what they would do. They're gone. That monotheistic enemy is gone. We deal now with uncertainty even more so than ever. And so it's very important that we have a broader doctrine that helps leaders stop and look at a problem, thoroughly analyze, develop understanding, and that helps to lead to a better peace in the end. It's the next step, and it's revolutionary in that sense that it's a different way to look at the world.
And the Army's role, I mean, what we're talking about, going back to my day, we had the civil affairs platoons and cap units and teams and all sorts of things like that. So to a small degree, we were trying to do some of those things. But is it because of the situation in Iraq, specifically Iraq, more so anywhere else, that the traditional role in military is to fight? And that's what you had the government for? State Department, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to come in and take care of some of these other things. But now the military, here's the way I'm looking at it. Military is, they're tasked with going in there far too often, go into situations where they can fight the battle, but they can't win the war because of all these other outside influences, because the government agencies, the politicians, whoever, isn't doing the job. So now the military has to take care of it. Not only do they have to fight the wars, fight the battles, but they have to make sure that certain other things are happening. People are being provided with food and water, and there's a government established, local government, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big burden to put on the military.
It's a burden, but that burden that shouldn't necessarily all fall on us. Part of that's being resolved. Congress appropriated $75 million to the Department of State to stand up what's called the Civilian Response Corps, which is a capability, an expeditionary capability that they should have had all along probably, but a lack of foresight on some just left that left the government without the ability to reach out in large numbers to be able to do those types of activities that you just mentioned. When there's nobody else on the street to do them, the military can pick up the ball. As we've seen that. We may not do it perfectly, but we'll do it as best as we can to our abilities. The true expertise, however, lies in the development of community. It lies in the State Department. It exists in other organizations. You want those people to be able to come in and do those jobs. But to be able to reach that point means that we have to do our job better. We have to be good enough to be able to go in and establish the conditions on the ground that allow them to come in and perform those missions. So we're not doing what we did in Afghanistan and Iraq and we continue to do today, which is nation building under fire. Those are not the optimal conditions to ask civilians of the other agencies to step in.
And time's critical in this too.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? I mean, you can provide all the information you want to the appropriate agencies, and by the time it trickles through the layers of bureaucracy, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road, they might start moving on it. They might start appropriating money to get some of these things done. Well, in the meantime, the military's stuck there dealing with the situation.
Which is amazing. The term you're talking about actually comes from the Vietnam era, the golden hour, that opportunity that you have where that's the prime opportunity to make those changes, to earn the trust and confidence of the people by taking immediate action. I was on the ground in 2003 when we entered Baghdad, and I can tell you to the day I remember driving through Momadiyeh, which is just south of Baghdad, where the streets were lined with people that were just ecstatic to see us. You could feel it in the air. There was excitement. There was hope. And a month later, I could drive down the same street and be shot at because that golden hour had already passed. We had allowed the civil situation to erode to a point between looting and crime and the lack of security. Things had already eroded to a point where you could feel it in the air again. They weren't so glad to see us. Their confidence was waning, and we were not able to take the actions that we needed to within that golden hour to do what we needed to do. We didn't have enough people on the ground to secure the population and secure their needs. We didn't have enough people to provide them the food and water that they needed to make sure their electricity was on, all the basic things that you take for granted in day-to-day life. They had that. And they lost it.
Right.
They looked at us, hey, we're here to provide you freedom. Okay, but does freedom have to come without power, without medical
right.
care, without sanitation, without food, without money? It shouldn't have to. It had a great promise, but not enough people on the ground to make sure that it was going to happen.
The new doctrine allows for something or provides for something that, again, has existed since we've had a military. And that's enabling leaders on the ground, the NCO, you know, all the Joes who are there to assess a situation and
right.
enables them to have the flexibility to deal with the situation relative to them and their surroundings,
yes.
their environment.
And that's, right? that's absolutely a key, too. The Stability Manual puts doctrine in their hands. It's a how-to book, a practitioner's guide on, for all intents and purposes, on how to rebuild a fallen nation. You hope that you won't have to do it by yourself, but if you had to, the fundamentals are there to walk you through as a company commander on the ground what has to be done. The basics, just fundamental principles on how to reestablish governance, how to ensure the security of the people, how to revitalize the economy. All of that's there, but it's also couched within the context of what we call the comprehensive approach to stability operations, which says you may need to be able to do all these things, but if you do certain things right, if you make sure there's security, there's law and order, and the essential services are taken care of, the food, the water, shelter, medical care, those three big things, if you do those right initially and establish the conditions that are appropriate, then the other agencies of the government, the international community, the UN, the allies, that makes their job that much easier to come in and relieve you of the burden of reestablishing governance, rebuilding the economy, standing up the infrastructure for a functioning nation. But the doctrine is there if they need it. And the ultimate hope being that you'll be able to work through the comprehensive approach with our partners, with the interagency community, with the others necessary to do all those things.
This goes back to what I was saying a second ago. It's something American soldiers have done to some degree
throughout our history.
Throughout our history. And it's a quote from General Caldwell. We're not teaching soldiers what to think in the school and centers. We're teaching them how to think critically, and how to think creatively.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's how this doctrine approaches all that. Is you can go through our history, 230 some years of these types of activities. It's common. I think that if you look across the course of our history, I think there were only 11 episodes of what you would consider major state-on-state conflict in our history. The rest of the hundreds of other operations are smaller-scale operations that tend to fall along these lines to one degree or another. But what we've never done is codify that, is to capture those lessons learned through history and codify it so the next generation didn't have to relearn the lessons of the past. Which is the critical piece of helping people with how to think. You give them the tool and say, "This is what we've learned through history." It makes it that much easier for them to think creatively, to apply critical reasoning to these problems.
It's contagious.
It is contagious.
A lot of military buffs out there, a lot of veterans, and I hope, like me, they're going to be fascinated by this. You know, my very humble opinion, I think this is a giant leap forward because, hey, you guys are right. You know, the world is a different place than it was back in the old Soviet Union days. The world's a pretty scary place. And the challenges the military faces now and in the future, I don't believe those challenges are going to diminish a bit. I just think that people step back a second and realize what an extremely smart army we have. We're not just a bunch of guys going out there and blowing things up, shooting things, and you know, it's a very smart army.
Well, we take a lot of cues from our past too, and if you just dial the clock back 40 years, you look at Vietnam. And in Vietnam, militarily, we were very successful. When we began to realize that we needed to relook the way we approached the civil population in South Vietnam and how we worked with them, and cords grew out of that effort. A lot of people, myself included, will say cords was too little, too late. We needed it sooner. But it wasn't a military failure in Vietnam. It really was a political failure.
Right.
But who got blamed?
Right. Yeah.
The military inevitably takes the blame when the rest of the government doesn't step up to the plate. We're left with the blame. We're left with the after effect, the humiliation, if you want to think that way. 40 years later, it's the same thing. We are militarily incredibly successful, but it's not the military instrument of national power that's going to win. It's got to be the political, the economic pieces, the information piece that is so critical to victory. But who's going to get the blame if this fails? It's
right.
Not going to be a failure of national strategy or policy. It's going to be a failure of the military to win. That's what makes this manual so important. People get the misconception that we're going to leave behind the cornerstones of our strength, the offense and defense, the combat operations piece. This isn't about that. This is about making sure that our leaders have the tools they need to be able to be successful, to integrate those tools early on so you're not fighting a long time before you realize it's time to transition. In 2003, 2004, we needed this manual. We didn't have it. We found ourselves in a counterinsurgency, and the end result was, you know, General Petraeus and the team that he put together writing the COIN manual to at least get that effort in place. And that manual influenced national strategy and influenced the strategy on the ground in theater. But it was vital a couple years before that. This is the same kind of thing. We needed this manual in 2004 to support the programs that are ongoing even today. We know, looking beyond Afghanistan and Iraq, both of those manuals are going to be critical at least for the next 50 years. We're going to be in the Middle East. We're going to be in Southwest Asia. We know that. But there's an entire continent in the Southern Hemisphere that this is going to be critical in. We need to have those thinking pieces in place now, because eventually when we turn our attention towards Africa and AFRICOM, they're going to need that. That's going to be critical. We don't want them to have to relearn those lessons and give them doctrine after the fact. We want all that to be in place now.
How well would this serve? Let's just step back a little bit. Europe, Eastern Europe specifically. You know, Russia is still a player.
Absolutely.
Some strange things going on, and Russia is definitely still a force to be reckoned with. I don't know how strong NATO is when it comes down to it, but say worst case scenario, and we somehow found ourselves embroiled in Eastern Europe. This new doctrine would serve us there also.
Absolutely. The operations doctrine that we published in February is absolutely critical to that. That's a revalidation of our warfighting doctrine, that the cornerstones of our strength remain. That has to be there. And the training has to be there to support that. That our forces have to be trained at those core combat skills first, because that's literally what we are expected to do. That's the whole fight and win our nation's wars piece of things. We have to be able to do that. At some point, you'll move to a place where you're going to need the stability piece of that doctrine, where you're going to need to understand all those things, because no matter what we do or where we go, we know we're going to operate among the populations of the world. And that's where the offense and defensive piece don't apply as well. The combat piece is critical, but when you're operating among people, you need the supporting doctrine to deal with populations, and that's what the Stability Operations Manual is all about.
Because it doesn't matter where it is, those populations have certain basic needs that need
absolutely.
To be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And no matter where you go, the support and trust and confidence of those people is critical. You can't ignore the populations, or you're not going to be able to win the peace in the long run.
So what do you do next after being so involved in this?
Ideally, go put it to practice in the field.
Yeah.
Get out, take it out, spread the gospel, absolutely put it in practice, and do it alongside the people that we wrote this with. That would be ideal. And the muddy boots operators of the world in the development community, in the NGO community, I'll see those people again out there, no doubt about it. Most of those people, they consider D.C. just a train stop on the way to Mozambique or Ghana or Kenya. Yeah, it's just a short stop back in civilization. Right now, we're pushing this to the joint force, hoping that we can establish the same level of doctrine, elevate this a little bit higher into the joint community, because the joint force still doesn't have any doctrine for this. Next month, try to sell that, and still continuing to work some broader thinking pieces that get at how we think and how we approach things. That stands a very likely chance of being just as revolutionary as this.
So this is new Army doctrine. How long is this going to take to?
People are already practicing this in the field. So the beauty of
this
whole
process.
Well,
they were before it was actually written down.
I drew a lot of what's in here straight from my own experiences in the 101st when we were working our way from Kuwait through Anajaf, Karbala, Baghdad, Mosul.
Let me interrupt you right there. When you were with who?
The 101st Airborne.
All right. I like to get that in there whenever I can.
But all the observations and all the lessons learned over that year in Iraq, we had terrific success in Mosul. All of that is right into this manual. It's all things that I saw, that I experienced, that I documented then, not knowing that I would do this one day. So this captures the lessons learned and the best practices of the last 7 years, but it also looks forward beyond that. So,
how long will it take for the doctrine to?
Absolutely. Yeah. Inculcating the doctrine in the field, it's an iterative process, but judging by the anticipation and excitement of folks out in the field, the closer we get to release, the more phone calls, traffic, email I see that says, hey, can I get a copy now? Can you get me a hard copy? Mail some here and there. Tremendous anticipation. Because this, it puts a practitioner's guide in the hands of the guys that need it most. The guys that do this stuff every day need this doctrine to help them sort through some of these things, because there's nothing that's really more complex than having to rebuild a nation. And we have we're well on our way in Iraq, probably in the hardest part of it now. Afghanistan, we're still to get there. Eventually we're going to need that. And when you tell some battalion commander, hey, your mission for the next year is to revitalize that economy. We need to shift that from this kind of an economy to a free market economy. I need you to establish microloans. To the average guy, none of that makes sense.
Right.
But the doctrine translates that into, here's how you do it. Here's how you establish a jobs program. Here's how you reopen a market. Here's how you choose one type of crop over another. Here's who you go to in the Department of Agriculture to help you establish policy along those lines. All that's there. And it makes somebody's job much easier. It becomes a one-stop shop for how to rebuild a country.
Yeah, it's in my opinion, it's really going to come into play in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
Because it's a much more complicated situation over there. People don't really, a lot of people there don't have a concept of central government, let alone any type of provincial government or anything like that.
Both countries present incredibly unique challenges. Now you have one that sits at the apex of three major ethnic groups, and then you have one, like you said, that's never been one to have a central government, and is at the crossroads of major civilizations, and throughout history has always
right.
been the La Brea tar pits of that part of the world. everybody who went through there got stuck.
Yeah.
Both of them create unique challenges, and both of them need this kind of doctrine to at least help the military get things moving in a certain direction alongside our other partners.
Well, I just want to thank you for taking the time and trying to explain this to me, because I'm not the smartest guy in the world, so... And I know our listeners will appreciate it. And again, I just want to express my appreciation to you and all your comrades and for everything you do.
We appreciate all the support, Jerry.
We owe you. So if there's anything you need, just holler.
Stay tuned for more of the National Defense after this.
The VFW is looking for a few more heroes. The largest combat veterans organization in America wants to get you involved and keep you active. With nearly 2 million members and 9,000 posts around the country, the VFW is doing the tough job of supporting our troops. You can be a part of all the excellent programs that keep the fires burning on the front lines. Programs such as Operation Uplink, with phone cards for active duty and hospitalized veterans, Adopt a Unit, which provides assistance for nearly 1,000 military units, and care package efforts for the troops serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. Only someone who's been there can understand what it means to be remembered. The VFW has been the heart and soul of the military for over 100 years. Isn't it time you stake your claim as a veteran? Call the VFW Membership Department at 1-888-JOIN-VFW or log on to VFW.org for more details. You've served your country. Now you can help your country serve others. Call 1-888-JOIN-VFW. That's 1-888-JOIN-VFW.
What do you want from the Wizard of Oz?
Just messing with you. But seriously, people don't want to stand in front of my big, awesome wizard head and hear me going, duh. They want answers. That's why I go to USA.gov, the official source for government info. It gives me the smarts to go with the show. Say someone asks for a brain. I go to USA.gov, type in student loans, and 4 years later, they're chock full of knowledge. Is the Wicked Witch terrorizing your neighborhood? Well, move. Then search USA.gov for change of address form so your friends can find you and the witch can't. How about if you're stuck here from Kansas and want to go home? Well, check out USA.gov for the latest travel restrictions and passport applications. I even use it for myself. Bought my sweet ride at a government auction I found on USA.gov. I call it the Wizmobile. Balloons are for squares.
For federal and state government information, there's no place like USA.gov.
Welcome back to National Defense. That was pretty fascinating stuff. You know, you hear about Army doctrine, and it sounds kind of dry, but boy, when it's a brand new one and new strategies going in place, that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and what a smart guy. What a good guy. He's going to be wearing stars on his shoulders.
Absolutely. I got a few stars in my head just listening to that. Hey, listen, we got next week, our old buddy Gordon is coming up from Sport Clips. They've got another big initiative that they're starting to raise money for Operation Uplink. That is huge. That's huge stuff. That's coming up next week. And we'll be back to tell you all about it right here on the National Defense. Thanks for listening.
I never thought that this is where I'd settle down. Thought I'd die an old man back in my hometown. They gave me this plot of land, me and some other men, for a job well done. There's a big white house, sits on a hill just up the road. The man inside, he cried the day they brought me home. They folded up a flag, told my mom and dad, we're proud of your son. And I'm proud to be on this peaceful piece of property. I'm on sacred ground and I'm in the best company. I'm thankful for those, thankful for the things I've done. I can rest in peace, I'm one of the chosen ones. I made it to Arlington. I remember Daddy brought me here when I was 8. We searched all day to find out where my granddad lay. And when we finally found that cross, he said, son, this is what it cost to keep us free. Now here I am, 1,000 stones away from him. He recognized me on the first day I came in, and it gave me a chill when he clicked his heels and saluted me. And I'm proud to be on this peaceful piece of property. I'm on sacred ground and I'm in the best of company. And I'm thankful for those, thankful for the things I've done. I can rest in peace, I'm one of the chosen ones. I made it to Arlington. And every time I hear 21 guns, I know they brought another hero home to us.